Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Debron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the second week of December. This week, we are very pleased to have Francis Wood and Govinda Rosling as our guests, here to tell us about their work with the Pidgeon-Guillemot Research Group on Whidbey Island. Last month, we had them all scheduled, and it was such wild weather. It's so beautiful out today. It's hard to remember that last month, it was so wild that the ferries were canceled, and they're coming from Whidbey Island. So we had arranged a phone interview, and then we had just as we were finishing up the phone interview, the power went out in the station, so we lost the whole thing. Anyway, we are so pleased to have you in person.
Yes, it's our pleasure as well to be right here in Port Townsend.
Well, we're so happy to have you. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this an interesting call? We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. In our general summary of the past week, the most obvious event is our extraordinary weather on several different fronts. Dr. Cliff Maths, atmospheric scientist at the University of Washington, couldn't get enough of it on his weather blog, from fog to smoke haze to temperature inversions and freezing roadways. Smoke from unusually late wildfires over Southern California have reached our region, producing reduced visibility and degraded air quality in some areas. At the same time, there has been a very strong inversion layer overhead, which, as Cliff vividly describes, has made for some very weird skiing. He's an avid skier, so he talks about the skiing at Alpental in Snoqualmie Pass and describes how last Thursday it was 25 degrees at the base, which is at 3,100 feet, but it was 50 degrees Fahrenheit at 5,470 feet at the top of the run. So can you imagine going from 50 degrees Fahrenheit to the low 20s in a run of a few minutes? It's quite the thrill. Some folks have also reported strange sound effects with a strong temperature inversion, hearing boat horns many miles away. To learn more, go to cliffmaths.blogspot.com.
Scott Duncan and Lonnie Summer did a birding tour of coastal sites near Port Townsend last Sunday and wrote in the University of Washington Tweeters site to report on it. Best bird was a yellow-billed loon seen at Point Hudson. Other highlights included an eared grebe at Fort Flagler State Park and an estimated 50 ancient murrelets and orcas at Port Wilson Lighthouse. They ended the day with a Eurasian widgeon at Ka Tai Lagoon. American widgeons are one of the most common duck species seen in our area in the wintertime, but occasionally a Eurasian widgeon can be seen among them. You have to look carefully, but you can distinguish them by the male's reddish head and yellowish forehead, as compared to the gray head and whitish forehead and green sweep behind the eye of the more common American species.
Weren't you telling me, Francis, that there's a yellow-billed loon that you can always see off the coast here in Port Townsend?
Oh, I remember years and years ago when I started birding in this area, that was notorious as the place that you could go to see a yellow-billed loon right here in the Port Townsend area. And every time I went out to look for it, it was there. It's probably the great granddaughter or grandson of that one that I originally saw. But
and did you say there's a man there that shows people that come out where the yellow
there's
loon
a wonderful
is.
Loon whisperer out there who will help you find it among the other bird species in that area, and with the stronger currents through there, he is delighted to show people around. It's been a while since I've spoken with him, and I really don't even remember his name, but maybe he's listening today, and if so, let us know.
Yeah. That's so cool.
He has helped me see that yellow-billed loon many, many times.
And speaking of interesting birds, I heard that some folks over on Whidbey saw 8 sandhill cranes fly over the Pacific Rim Institute just south of Coopville a few days ago. Did either of you guys see them? Do you think they were part of a very late migration south, or do you occasionally get them overwintering on the island?
This is Govinda here, and there are sandhill cranes that are at the migratory bird sanctuary George C. Rifle up in Delta, BC. There is a flock up there, and as we were discussing, that by the crane flies, that may only be about 50 miles from that Delta, BC area. I have seen them up there in the summertime, and actually I have a little story that I watched a juvenile be fed a salmonberry by its parent. And if you think about the crane and how long that bill is, and how, when you yourself pick a salmonberry, how squishy it is, and the dexterity that this bird could take the salmonberry intact and feed
that,
it to
that
its offspring.
Is such a cool image. I had no idea that there were cranes that were there year-round so close to us. And the image of plucking salmonberries and feeding them to their young is just so delightful.
It was great to watch.
And that's some place that people can go see them then year-round. You were telling me about that area.
It's just outside of Ladner. It's the George C. Rifle Migratory Bird Sanctuary. There is a small fee that you pay to get in, and there's feeding at the beginning of the sanctuary, but it's at least a few acres that you can walk around and do some more serious birding on the outskirts. Now we move to the marine environment. Puget Sound Keeper Alliance has just started a new study to gauge the level of pollution in Puget Sound using mussels, which have been placed in test cages in various locations around the region. Mussels are just one species used for water quality testing, but they are especially good subjects because they are filter feeders and contaminants will deposit in their tissue. The mussels will stay on site in cages for the next 90 days, after which they will be sent to the lab to test for toxics. The result could have long-range applications for helping scientists track the health of our ecosystem and help protect marine wildlife from mussels to the orca.
Well, I've always loved pigeon guillemots, but I didn't realize until recently that there's been a research group studying them for over a decade right across the water from us. So we're so pleased to have two members of their group, Francis Wood and Govinda Rosling, join us to speak about their research today. Francis Wood is a writer, artist, and naturalist, and was co-creator and writer for Bird Note, one of our very favorite radio programs, and it was indeed a major inspiration for this radio show. And Francis was also instrumental in starting the Pigeon Guillemot Research Group about 12 years ago over on Whidbey Island. And Govinda Rosling grew up on Whidbey Island and has been involved with the Guillemot Research Group for the last 7 years. Govinda also coordinates the South Whidbey Christmas Bird Count, and we'll talk about that a little bit towards the end of our program. Welcome to Nature Now, Francis and Govinda. Perhaps we should start by describing what pigeon guillemots are for those in our radio audience not familiar with these delightful seabirds.
Yes, this is Frances, and they are delightful seabirds. Pigeon guillemots are really marine birds, but if you can imagine a chunky little bird, mainly black with bright fire engine red legs and feet, and they have a white splash on their wings. They're probably called pigeon guillemots because maybe at first glance they look like a pigeon sitting out on the sea somewhere.
But they do have so much more elegant than a pigeon.
They do have kind of a small head, so maybe that's how they got their name. So pigeon guillemots are part of the alcid family. Also in that family are the puffins. You probably are familiar with that bird, and also murres and murrelets. These are strong swimmers, and they are really designed for swimming underwater to catch their prey. They spend most of their life out in the water and mainly come on shore just for the breeding season.
They also have really specialized bills. The puffins people know, those really heavy bills that are meant to carry a bunch of fish, but the guillemots have that wild, bright red inside their mouths. Looking from the outside, it's a long, strong, dark bill meant to carry like one fish at a time, right?
Yeah, so these are just straight pointed beaks as opposed to that very wide flattened beak of, say, the puffin. They have different feeding strategies, thus the different shapes of beaks. The guillemots will pick up one prey. We watch them as they deliver these prey to their young, and there's always just one prey in their mouth. Whereas if you haven't seen a puffin, you've probably seen pictures of them, that very colorful dandy of a bird with multiple little fish in its mouth kind of drooping over the lower beak. They have an amazing way of being able to hold one fish in the back of their mouth and be able to catch another fish and then hold it in the back of the mouth and move forward.
It's all tied together, which is so cool. The more you read, the more you understand things and how they then can carry prey from farther away, right? The pigeon guillemots tend to feed closer to their nest sites, while the puffins will carry prey, a whole stack of prey from a longer distance away, right? There's so many things to talk about. We're like into fish now, but back to their what they look like. They're unmistakable in their breeding plumage, but they can be confusing to identify at times in the winter due to their radical change in coloration, right?
This is Govinda here. And yes, they are in that winter plumage from, say, October to February. And in the breeding plumage, as Frances mentioned, it was blackbird with that white splash and the black wedge in there of that wing patch. In the wintertime, they're really more white colored, a little more dusky. They still have the red feet if you can see them, but they will always have that little black wedge in that white wing patch, but they do look very different in the winter. And then come February, as they're molting into that breeding plumage, then they get like maybe the pigeony look to them. They get all speckled. Uh-huh. And you can see that over on the other side of the water at Keystone is sort of a build bird up site that we do see a lot in the early spring or late winter of these like speckled pigeon guillemots as they're changing to that breeding plumage.
Oh, cool. And the sexes are identical in both breeding and non-breeding plumage, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. You don't know which is which until you see them mate.
What about the juveniles? They can be confusing too, right? They sometimes look like adults in their non-breeding plumage.
Yes. The juveniles, I would say, maybe are a little more brown and dusky after they fledge and they're just kind of palling around in the water. In the wintertime, I would say they're just a little bit, maybe a little darker around the eye and maybe a little more dusky.
Their wing patch is not necessarily as defined as the adults. But you can still, if you look carefully, it's there. It's just kind of shadowed with more of a speckled or salt and pepper kind of look to it.
But by the time the breeding season comes along, the juveniles will be in breeding plumage.
Yes, right. So the next spring, they all look, again, pretty much solid black.
What about their life cycle? Do they breed at certain periods of time? And then what do they do in the wintertime?
These are what I would call marine birds. They spend their life on the water. They are sleeping on the water, diving down, catching their food underwater, and hanging out on the water in good feeding areas until around April or May when they return to their breeding colonies. And they then congregate near the base of high bluffs and hang out there in their breeding colonies and go through their breeding cycles through the summer until around August, September, when they all start leaving. As the young fledge, they all will leave the breeding areas and then again disperse out into marine waters. We do not band the birds that we watch on Whidbey Island, so we don't know where they go. But from the literature that we've read, we understand that they will go to good feeding areas and spend the rest of the year there.
But not too far offshore. They're considered
right.
Near shore marine birds.
Right.
And the term pelagic is always a little confusing. They're not true pelagic birds.
Well, I think of pelagic birds as like the shearwaters that really stay way offshore and would go to nest on remote islands and so forth, whereas I think of these more as marine birds since we do see them for several months right here on the shores of the Salish Sea in large numbers.
They don't dive deep the way like murres will. That they feed on the bottom but not deep bottom, right?
Exactly. They're eating mainly what we find in our study, at least what they're delivering to their young are the gunnels and the sculpins, which are benthic fish, not in very deep water, like you mentioned.
Uh-huh. Yeah. How did you get started with the study, and how long has it been going on?
About 13 years ago, I had been doing the breeding bird survey for Seattle Audubon, and that had finished up, and I had loved that research that I had been doing with them, and I was quite interested in having found various colonies of guillemots around Whidbey Island. And so I went into our Audubon meeting one day and asked if anyone would be interested in joining me and studying these birds. And I got some volunteers that day, and then from there it's just increased over the years. So we now have about 1,000 birds that we study around Whidbey Island, and they break up into about 26 colonies. So it's been a really fun project, citizen science project, that has involved a lot of volunteers and scientific research, and we've now actually mentored other groups to start projects in other parts of the Salish Sea.
So what's the main objective of your study?
Govinda here. Basically, we want to collect the breeding success of pigeon guillemots. We want to find out what they're choosing to feed their chicks, looking at how many guillemots are out in the water, so the populations, how many burrows they're occupying, and how often they're feeding these fish types to their chicks. And another objective is really to have this ongoing and long-term study continuing year after year, so we know what normal is. So we can have this baseline of data and really to have just eyes on the beach. So if or when a disaster may occur, we can act a lot more quickly.
People forget how important it is to have baseline information. I mean, I think that that's one of the main objectives of the University of Washington Coast Program, too. While they're documenting dead birds, you're getting a baseline of what's normal. Otherwise, you don't have anything to compare it to when disaster strikes.
Absolutely.
And I was reading that pigeon guillemots are particularly susceptible to oil spills, too, because they're feeding in the nearshore environment.
Yeah, they are very susceptible to changes that may happen in the water column, whether it be oil spills or maybe other toxins. So for us to look at the guillemots, we know that if their numbers start to go down, then there may be a larger problem at bay.
Why are pigeon guillemots such an important species for us to monitor in our area?
The $20,000 question.
I know. People always want to know, well, why should I volunteer for that project? Or why should I donate money to that one versus any other one?
Yeah, we look at pigeon guillemots. For one, they are the only seabird that commonly nests throughout the Salish Sea. There's a lot of them. They're easy to spot. This is an observational study. So like Francis said, we're not banding them. We're just watching them with a pair of binoculars. So it's an easy thing that we can collect data on year after year. They are a key indicator of the health of the Salish Sea. So for one, they're easy to find. And two, they can tell us a lot about the health of the nearshore environment.
And there really aren't other seabirds. So this is a category, I'm not talking about gulls here or ducks, but seabirds that breed in the Salish Sea. So it is a very common bird that we can track.
And they're easy to see. They're close. For people that aren't going out to survey in a boat, you can survey from the coast, right? And
right.
Get an idea of what's going on instead of having to make a major survey effort to go offshore to locate them. We have run out of time for today. We're going to have to come back to part two next month. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we're happy to have you. We have some great upcoming natural history events to tell you about. The Olympic chapter of the Washington Native Plant Society is meeting for a hike on Thursday, December 14th, to explore the newly constructed Manzanita Trail in the Miller Peninsula State Park. The plan is to meet at Fat Smitty's on Discovery Bay at 10 a.m. to carpool. Contact Dixie at cablespeed.com for more information and to sign up.
Also, the Jefferson Land Trust Geology Group is hosting a lecture on LIDAR, L-I-D-A-R, which stands for Light Detection and Ranging. this Saturday, December 16th at 4 p.m. at the Quimper Unitarian Church. LIDAR is a cutting-edge mapping technique that is changing the way that scientists view the world. Go to quimpergeology.org for more details.
Join the Olympic Peninsula Audubon chapter up in Squim for their brand new series of classes, Focus On, where they will unlock the secrets of seven different bird families. The first class meets this Saturday from 10 a.m. to noon and focuses on owls. Go to their website at olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org for more information.
And continuing on birds, the biggest event of the week is, of course, the 118th Annual Audubon Christmas Bird Count, otherwise known as the CBC. So, Govinda, are you still heading up the South Whidbey Island Count?
Yeah, I'm the compiler for the South Whidbey Count. That will be on December 30th. I would say what we really need, we need help with people making food. So if you make a mean lasagna or a mean squash soup, these hungry birders are gathering at the Trinity Lutheran Church in Freeland for our post-tabulation, and we would love to have some of your soup.
Yeah, well, so the way the CBC works, people go out and gather their information for however long they can be out there. And
yes.
Then at the end, there's a tabulation. It's always really fun for people to bring what they've seen, and they do a count of their circle.
Yes, and this information is free and open to the public, and you can go to the National Audubon website. Usually it goes through a review. I think by maybe September or October, that previous year's count is on the website for any person to look at.
It's great. And there are several counts going on in our area. Saturday, the 16th of December, is the Port Townsend count. Monday, the 18th of December, is the Squim Dungeness count. Nature Now mentioned last week an event on, I think, the 9th of December. But that was just the warm-up. The official count is the 18th, this Monday. And the Port Angeles count is at the end of the month, on Saturday, December 30th. So contact your local chapter now to figure out how best to plug in with what they need. Mostly, probably food at this point.
Yes.
Here's our mystery sound again. That sound is a pigeon guillemot. So, Frances and Govinda, I'll leave it to you to talk about the mystery sound.
This is Frances. That's such a wonderful sound, that trilling noise. We hear a lot of this when we're studying the birds. We often hear them on the water singing back and forth to each other. But also what's very fun is if perhaps one of the birds will be in the burrow incubating. And while sitting on the beach, you can hear them calling from the burrow and then also hearing some kind of a response happening out on the water. So particularly given that many seabirds have just a very grunting sound, a very non-melodic noise, these guillemots have such a really a very pleasant sound. It's so much fun to hear their trilling, their vocalizations.
So do they vocalize during the wintertime too, or is it mostly during the breeding season?
This is Govinda here, and I'm just trying to think about that. I don't think so. In the summertime, they are really congregating and as colonial nesters, so there's a lot of them around. In the winter, you might just have maybe one or two. We saw a few on the ferry ride over here, but they weren't really talking much to each other.
Right, that socialization comes with the breeding period in the spring and then through the summer, which is not to say you might hear a couple of them talking in the winter, but it's not anywhere near as obvious.
Well, that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the second week of December. And thanks so much for joining me, Frances and Govinda. It's been such a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you, Deborah. It's been a lovely time over here in Port Townsend. Beautiful day.
It is a
lot better than the day we scheduled earlier.
It's amazing how things change, isn't it? If you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday. 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. As always, happy trails.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing music is Fleet from the group Guillemot. Somebody hold me until you know.